From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Joe Biden's big speech on January 6th, the Supreme Court's arguments on vaccine mandates, and a disappointing Friday jobs report. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnists Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. Bill, we already talked on the previous episode about January 6th and the Capitol riot, the anniversary of that, but I wondered if I could get your just a quick reaction to President Biden's speech. He made a very pointed argument that the 2020 election was not stolen, so that the rioters last year were acting based on a lie, based on misinformation. And although Biden didn't mention Trump's name, listen to this.
He's not just a former president. He's a defeated former president, defeated by a margin of over 7 million of your votes in a full and free and fair election. There is simply zero proof the election results are inaccurate.
Biden getting a little heated there. Bill, I wonder what you made of his speech.
I thought it was a real missed opportunity to bring the country together in a way. And I think that's just because the Democrats have decided that the January 6th is the best weapon they have for getting, you know, some of their legislation through. And I think Joe Biden sort of, he indulges this kind of thing. And I think we could have put it in a larger perspective. Look, it was a terrible thing. I agree that the evidence didn't support the President Trump's claims. But I think, again, what people are seeing now is we've got this committee commission on Capitol Hill designed to politicize it and use it as a weapon against Republicans. I think it's just going to make things worse.
Kim, I wonder what your take is. And another thought I would throw out here is a point made by the Journal's editorial on Biden's speech. And it cites another line of his. He said, "Our democracy held, we the people endured, and we the people prevailed," unquote. And then the editorial goes on to point out that there were a lot of Republicans even who opposed Trump's claims about the election. There was Vice President Mike Pence who refused to intervene in the counting of the Electoral College vote. There was Attorney General Bill Barr who said there was no evidence of fraud. There was a Secretary of State in Georgia, Brad Raffensperger. There were textualist and originalist judges, including those appointed by President Trump, who refused to entertain these claims in court. There were all the Republican state legislators in red states who did not consider throwing out the popular vote and trying to substitute their own electors. And so, Kim, that's something that is, I think, being missed here. And the editorial at least makes the argument that Biden's stance there in the speech was a contrast to a lot of what you're hearing from the rest of the Democratic Party.
Well, your first point about his argument that democracy held, he definitely is at odds with a lot of the reigning political views on the left and in the media. That would like to suggest that because of what happened on January 6th, we face continued peril, that there's already a coup in the making for 2024, when in reality, and as we have made the point many times, our institutions absolutely held, and we didn't come close to losing that day. And in part because of the actions of many, many Republicans. And that's where I think the Biden speech really failed, is that the Democratic priority at the moment going into the election is to present the Republican Party as the party of insurrectionists, of violence, to claim that Democrats believe in democracy and Republicans don't. And as a result, he, during his speech, made a couple of passing references to a few generic Republicans who he said did the right thing. But overall, his intention with this speech was to paint the entire party as undemocratic. And that is just not something that is going to fly with a lot of Americans. And I think the other failing of the speech was to tie January 6th with Democratic electoral prerogatives or political and policy prerogatives to suggest that somehow you needed to pass this voting rights bill in order to deal with January 6th. And as we went through in the podcast yesterday, I mean, this is nonsense. The bill not only is no antidote to January 6th, but would create a lot more skepticism of voting laws in a way that could undermine elections going forward, too.
Now on to the big news on Friday, which is the Supreme Court hearing arguments on the White House's vaccine mandates. including one from OSHA, which requires vaccine or weekly testing by employers with 100 workers or more. And one thing, Bill, that I thought was notable listening to the argument was the liberal justices, Justice Stephen Breyer, for example, focused very much on outcomes of these mandates and with the state of the virus. There's mentions of the Omicron variant. Here's a clip of Justice Stephen Breyer.
How can it conceivably be in the public interest, with 750,000 people yesterday, goodness knows how many today, but you have the hospitalization figures growing by factors of 10 times what it was. You have hospitalization at the record, near the record. How can it be in the public interest, which is a requirement? That's what I want to hear the answer to.
And Bill, what strikes me about that is that's a question that does not seem to involve a whole lot of law.
I was going to say, my question is, where's the legal argument in there? And I think it's really scary because the three of the liberal justices seemed okay with going along with anything so long as you can put a public health benefit on it when the issue is very narrow. I mean, the question is whether these federal agencies, absent an explicit warrant of Congress, have the authority to do what they're doing. That's a very important question, not only involving states' rights, but you think if they allow this to stand, we're going to have so many more things done in the name of public health. It is such a gift to the Biden administration and to progressives if that's allowed through, because then you can just call something, you know, a public health measure and you ask less questions about it. You know, as the judge recently put it in the Navy SEALs case, they had sued over the mandate for the military about getting shots. He ruled in their favor. They were arguing for religious exemption, and he said, you know, COVID-19 is not an exception in the Constitution. You still have to abide by the Constitution. And I was very alarmed by the tenor of the arguments today.
Kim, how about you? The conservatives, to my eye, were focused a lot on what they call the major question doctrine. Can you give a sense of what that means and how that could play out in a decision on this?
Sure. You saw Gorsuch go there and Kavanaugh go there, both looking at this doctrine, which goes to the question of whether or not in really big issues that affect sweeping parts of the population, you don't need, in fact, Congress to, and prior decisions have put it this way, to speak very clearly on that issue before regulators move. And so you saw the conservative justices asking a lot of questions about what rises to the level of a major question. Would this not fit the bill? You also saw them querying a lot of the other different flaws of this regulation. You had Alito, for instance, talking about the fact that this was unprecedented in that this is a workplace rule that extends beyond the workplace, meaning if you have a vaccine, it affects you outside of the office as well as inside of the office. You had Thomas talking about whether or not this rule wasn't just so broad and blunt as to not take into account questions of relative risks of different age groups, or, for instance, the fact that people who work in very crowded meatpacking plants are in a very different situation as the truck driver who drives alone all day. And you had Amy Coney Barrett bringing up the question of what really counts as an emergency and how long do regulators get to claim it goes on? She asked, you know, is this still going to be an emergency 2 years from now? At what point would you really have to go through a regular rulemaking process, which you skipped because you claim this was an emergency? All of which hints at the idea that this vaccine mandate, at least the OSHA one, could have some real problems.
Yeah, and the broadness of the OSHA one in particular is what strikes me. I think if the OSHA regulation were written more narrowly to focus, as Kim brings up, on assembly lines or specific jobs where people are packed close together, or maybe where they can't wear certain masks or other equipment that might be protective, maybe that would help. And maybe if this were a disease that were more risky, like something like polio, which is what Justice Gorsuch brought up, if it were smallpox, maybe that would help the federal government. But this is written in such a broad way Bill, that you start to raise the question of if OSHA can do this to any workplace in the country or every workplace in the country, then what can't OSHA do?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the question. And it's very clear to anyone that looks at it with any sense that when Congress passed OSHA's law, when it gave them this authority, it had no idea about pandemics or something. It was not thinking of that. You know, this OSHA has a warrant for workplace safety, workplace issues. This is a larger issue than the workplace. So I feel that if this is allowed to go through, I don't see what the limiting principle is going ahead, because the one control on federal bureaucracies is that the insistence, as the justices insisted last year on Biden's eviction moratorium, that Congress has to be explicit in granting these powers. And it's very dangerous. You know, the people at OSHA and so forth aren't elected. It's very dangerous to just give them the power because it sounds good. It sounds like a public health measure.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Before the break, Bill brought up the point that these administrators at OSHA are not elected. And that's a nice segue to the other clip we have from Justice Elena Kagan. Listen to this.
This is a politically accountable policy. It also has the virtue of expertise. So on the one hand, the agency, with their political leadership, can decide. Or on the other hand, courts can decide. Courts are not politically accountable. Courts have not been elected. Courts have no epidemiological expertise. Why in the world would courts decide this question?
So Justice Kagan's argument there, Kim, is essentially that as unaccountable as OSHA people may be, they are still accountable to the president. The president can tell them what to do. The president can hire and fire the political appointees in charge of that administration. And so they're at least more accountable than the courts are. How, Kim, do you respond to that?
Well, the courts have a certain measure of political accountability in that the presidents put them forward and they are obviously confirmed by the Senate judges. But this was an interesting twist on another debate that is headed for the court for a while, and Justice Kagan seemed to be making a peremptory bid to recast the framework of that, which is, of course, this question of Chevron deference and whether or not courts simply owe deference to regulators usually for the reasons of expertise or because they know what they're doing. She adds in here the argument of political accountability. This has been a doctrine that people are looking at more closely because a number of the newer members of the court have been very skeptical of it. It's a generational question. Over the last decades, increasingly you have seen administrative agencies and regulators take more and more powers into their hands, sometimes incredibly overtly, where you had presidents like Barack Obama, who for a long time said, I can't act on climate change until Congress passes something. Then when Congress refused to do it, he just had his regulators do it anyway. And you've seen a whole generation, especially of more conservative justices, begin to really push back on this. And there's been a lot of questions as to whether or not Chevron is going to get curtailed under this new more conservative court. So this seemed to be a dry run on that a little way, or at least one of the liberal justices there, again, arguing that this is what it's currently in law and we shouldn't mess with it. And here's the arguments why.
After Justice Kagan said that, there was another question by Justice Neil Gorsuch that I took to be as a little bit of a response to her. He said, I think we all agree that we are supposed to figure out who decides this question about the vaccine mandates, but it's not between unaccountable or accountable administrators at OSHA or wherever, and the courts, it's between OSHA and Congress. So that was his pitch. And Bill, I think Kim makes a good point here, in comparison to Chevron, even on questions of non-delegation, whether Congress can give handoff power in such broad ways to administrators. It seems like there has been a growing movement on the conservative side among these judicial nominees, younger lawyers, to say that courts should have a more active role in policing these separation of powers.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the court should have a more active role. I think it's Congress. If Joe Biden really wanted this, thought it was a good idea, he should bring it to a Congress where he has, you know, majorities in both the House and the Senate. Now, he has some difficulties there on some of the individuals, but that's the way you should go. We're supposed to be ruled via our elected representatives. And the dirty secret is that a lot of people like federal agencies doing it because they avoid the blame themselves. Congress doesn't have to take a controversial vote. They don't have to decide. So a lot of times they like the dirty work being done by a federal agency because there's no accountability for them. And I think even presidents would say that they have a hard time controlling some of their federal agencies. And finally, the last idea of these federal agencies as these objective repositories of dispassionate people with no politics, I mean, that's ridiculous. Most of them are filled with some sort of activist or another, and it can flip from side, from political aisle to the other political aisle. But I think part of living in a free society is not being ruled by these groups and being ruled by our elected representatives. Unfortunately, the dilemma is the elected representatives like to pass the buck.
So, Kim, what economic effect do you think this vaccine mandate will have if it is allowed to go into effect by the Supreme Court? And notable that this argument is going on while we are getting a job report. The Journal News article on it says that employers added 199,000 jobs in December. That is a slowdown. It's below the average monthly growth in 2021 of about 540,000. And so there are some economic headwinds, and there are some workers who have said that they would quit rather than comply with a vaccine or a testing mandate.
This is an argument that the plaintiffs in these cases hit on again and again. About the economic costs, and pointing out that that was another fatal problem with these rules, is that the administration didn't bother to do a real accounting of what it would mean for the economy, something that would normally happen if you went through a regular rulemaking process rather than doing things on an emergency basis. But the facts of this jobs report certainly back them up today. I think some of the notable numbers that are also out there floating around, it's not just that you had lower job numbers than expected. The hiring slowed down from 250,000 jobs last month and down from 650,000 in October. But we are still 3.6 million jobs short of where we were prior to the pandemic. You have entire sectors, in particular leisure and hospitality, that are still more than a million jobs down. And here's the other figure that really jumped out at me, is that we have close to the highest ever level of job openings in the history of the country, with some estimated by one private analysis, 12 million job openings. And that is partly a function, as you said, of the fact that people are quitting rather than face some of these vaccine mandates. A lot of people have no incentive to go get jobs, given that they're still getting transfer payments from the government. Inflation is really taking a bite, and it means that for many people, even though you've seen wage increases go up, they're not keeping up with inflation. So in fact, they're seeing a paycheck cut if they bother to go to work. All of this is increasingly, it's very easy to draw the straight line between a lot of the policies that are coming out of the federal government and that economic situation.
Bill, what's your read of this jobs report, and particularly as we start heading into the November midterm elections and President Biden's ratings and the economy are pretty dismal?
Yeah, I think you could never take any one jobs report as, you know, signifying everything about the economy. But the context is, has been kind of low, the job creation. And it comes, we're just talking about the Supreme Court mandate. I think the estimate is that if it's allowed to take effect Monday, I think as it was scheduled, 1% to 3% of employees would lose their jobs, would stay home rather than get the vaccine. That can't help. And I think that's the dilemma the president is in, especially with inflation. At some point, I think they're going to have to raise rates. And that's a problem for them and slowing job growth. So this is a real warning for them, and people are going to feel it. The way they feel inflation now, they're going to feel all the other economic problems if he doesn't come to grips with it.
And the danger, it seems to me, is that it risks becoming more persistent than transitory. We know that if people are out of the labor force, the longer that they stay out, the harder it is to draw them back into the labor force sometimes. And the Biden administration's whole argument on inflation has been that it's caused by kinks in the supply chain. And once those get worked out, that things will go back to normal or toward normal, at least. But Kim, if employers can't find workers to get their products made, to get their products shipped, that suggests, at least to me, that maybe we're going to have an inflation problem, keep going on throughout 2022. And Kim will give you the last word here.
Well, right. And just to give an example of how this can work in practice and how the federal response is so backward and potentially will make things worse, I'll just do this briefly. But obviously, we saw the president this week go after the meat industry, just as previously to that, he'd gone after oil suppliers, trying to suggest that their actions and a lack of competition were the cause of higher prices. If you go and look, and it's true, I mean, that there's a question, most meat production, meat packing in this country is done by four or five big companies, but it's not as if suddenly overnight they decided to gouge people. The problem that they're having are labor shortages. They can't get enough people to do it, which means fewer products, which means higher prices. And the administration's answer to this false claim of anti-competition is to say, hey, we're going to throw a bunch of money at smaller businesses to make them more competitive with these guys. The problem is those smaller businesses are facing and will face the exact same labor shortage problems. So that's not going to make a difference. And meanwhile, the administration used this as a crisis, as an opportunity to impose on the industry a whole bunch of regulations that progressives have wanted to oppose for a long time, all of which are going to result in more costs for those businesses, which will get passed on to consumers and make prices higher. So, you know, this is to go to your point, until this administration acknowledges the real drivers behind these inflation numbers, many of which are their own policies, they're going to continue to make things worse, not better.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app, and we will be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.